This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. In his many years working to rescue people from the cusp of death, Evan Alexander would occasionally run across someone who had one of those stories. You know, where somebody said they'd gone out of their body, traveled through a tunnel, seen a beautiful light, been enveloped in love, and now knew, absolutely knew, there was no such thing as death. Evan tried to be kind to these patients. He didn't want to denigrate their experience, but he was a scientist. He trained at some of the best medical schools in America, had been a professor of neurosurgery at Harvard, and he knew, absolutely knew, that so-called near-death experiences were just examples of the human brain playing tricks on itself. Until Evan nearly died himself, and had an experience that could not be explained by brain science, because while he was in that coma, he was all but brain dead. Dr. Alexander's new book is titled Proof of Heaven, and it will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. Its author, Dr. Evan Alexander, is our guest. Dr. Alexander, welcome back to the Inside Airwaves.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, Evan, you were last here, it's a bit more than a year and a half ago, and you've been busy since then. You've finished this new book, just published now by Simon & Schuster. You've appeared on 2020, ABC's Nightline, Dr. Oz, been on the cover of Newsweek. You've even recorded an interview with Oprah that airs soon, and we've actually got a clip from that interview that we will play a bit later, along with some more information about it. But in addition to everything I just mentioned, in recent weeks, you've done dozens, if not hundreds, of other interviews and public appearances.
There have been
so my question, are you exhausted?
No, it's very energizing. I mean, I think you probably know as well as anyone, I do enjoy telling my story. I think it's important to get out there. And when I figured out what it all meant, which was a few months after my coma, I knew I had to get my story out there.
Okay. Well, we need to do a bit of setup here because there are three groups of people listening right now. In one group, those who might be called true believers, for whatever reason, they absolutely need to see life after death as real, and it does not matter what you say. Their response is going to be, see, he's a doctor, he knows, so it has to be true. Second group, we could probably call them the fervent skeptics. Pretty much makes no difference what they hear from you, what kind of credentials you have, even how scientific you sound in your explanations. They are only interested in poking holes in your story. And with that kind of commitment, they're going to find some reasons in their minds to decide to ignore everything you have to say. So it's the third group that I most want to give you a chance to talk with today. Now these are going to be people who are listening with some cautious skepticism, but also with an open mind. And for the sake of anyone in that third group, I need to ask you about and maybe even press you on a couple of key points of your story. Okay?
All right. That sounds good.
All right. You were adopted.
Yes.
How old were you when you found out that your parents, the people who raised you, were not your biological parents?
It's something that I was told, as far as I can tell, all the way back to the beginning. I mean, there was never a big aha moment where it's like, oh, they just told me something that is a shock to me. I mean, they told me from before I could understand things to the point where I just knew and accepted that I was chosen, as they put it. But that they were not my biological parents.
There would come a time as an adult when you would try unsuccessfully a number of times to locate your biological parents. That story actually plays in a key way with what happened with your near-death experience.
Yeah.
So let's hold on to that, and I'll get back to that. But tell me what the neocortex is.
The neocortex is the outer surface of the brain, and in fact, everything that we think of that makes us human and that is involved in our construction of consciousness, of our awareness of everything around us and our interpretation of what it means, you know, how we use language, how we put together visual images, auditory images, speech, all of that is done by the cortex. The cortex is the most powerful calculator in the brain, and it's what handles all the real heavy lifting of putting together our conscious awareness.
So you fell into a coma in November of 2008. It happened extremely quickly, and the doctors who were treating you would eventually determine that you had somehow contracted this incredibly rare form of bacterial meningitis?
Yes, E. coli.
Is it your contention that because of what happened to your brain, to your neocortex in your brain, while it was under attack from that disease, that you could not have simply had any kind of dream or series of hallucinations?
That's true. It took me months to come to that conclusion because originally the experience was so rich and involved and complex. In fact, it was too real to be real. And as I, you know, was coming back from my coma and starting to get back to my life and was fascinated with this incredible adventure I'd been on, I wanted to explain it as a neuroscientist. I wanted to write it up as a neuroscientific report. And it was very fortunate that I had severe bacterial meningitis, because really no other diagnosis would do as well to help me eliminate the 9 hypotheses that I came up with to try and explain how this might have happened in my brain.
There is so much in your story. You told a lot of it when you were with us a year and a half ago. Much of it is in your new book, although I understand that the new book is about a quarter of the size of the manuscript
right.
that you originally wrote.
Well, I wrote it for myself. I had to understand all this. That's why it was so long.
Well, we could spend the rest of the hour just talking about what you've already said publicly that you experienced. But I do want to give people time to ask you some questions and to hop around some with some of these queries about whether people will believe that you did, in fact, find proof that an afterlife and that heaven exist. But let's get into a little of the story of those 7 days that you were in a coma, that you were not consciously aware of anything going on around you. Your book actually tells a fair amount about what your family and the doctors were going through that you found out later.
Right.
But at some point, for some time, while you are almost close to brain dead, in this coma, you're experiencing something that starts with what you call the worm's eye view.
Yeah, in the book, I call it the earthworm's eye view. And that was really my first awareness in coma. The meningitis had done a beautiful job of completely wiping out my neocortex and all of my memories of my life on Earth, all knowledge of humans on Earth, and of this universe, language, words, all those things were gone. And
so you all of a sudden existed. I almost said woke up in this universe, but you really, as you reported, don't have any awareness of waking up. You were just there. You
right.
had no reason to think that you weren't always there. You didn't have a body. You just had a sense of awareness.
Right. It was a murky, kind of foamy. I mean, it was very much as if I were buried in dirty jello.
And at some point in time, you began to experience some sense of yearning for something different.
Well, it went on for such a long time, and it was so monotonous. And part of the problem was that, certainly I don't think that I remembered much from moment to moment, and that was part of why it seemed to be so eternal. And although initially, and it sounds foreboding when I describe the nature of that place, but since I didn't remember anything else, it was not as bad as it sounds. But over a long, long period of time, it did seem to get somewhat suffocating in its nature.
And as you started to yearn for something different, this is where the part of the story that people really latch on to began to happen. Tell us about some of that part of what you call an extraordinarily beautiful experience.
Well, it was at some point in that Earthworm Eye view when I was really down near the bottom, which to me was kind of the most shocking part of it. Absolutely unresponsive, monotonous, kind of pounding. And then came this slowly spinning white light, kind of a filamentous light, and it was associated with a perfect melody. And for the longest time, I just heard this pounding, like somebody pounding on an anvil in that Earthworm Eye view. So to all of a sudden get this lovely, captivating, perfect melody and the slowly spinning white light was such a gift. And it came closer and closer, and then it opened up like it was a rip in the fabric of everything around me and led up into this idyllic, verdant valley. I still had no body image, so I was moving because I was a speck on a butterfly wing. And it was an absolutely gorgeous butterfly, colors beyond the rainbow, and colors that were shifting all over. So clearly not, you know, a butterfly like we would have on Earth, kind of an idealized form. And of course, that hangs up a lot of the skeptics, as do other words that I have to use to describe it. But you got to remember, we're stuck with earthly language to describe any of these things. But it was very, I mean, this is not some literary metaphor. This is exactly what was there every time I went in.
To the extent that you can put it in words.
Right. I mean, basically, it's just the facts, ma'am. I just, you know, put the story out there as best I could. Now,
there was another creature who came to you.
Yes. There was an absolutely beautiful girl sitting beside me on this butterfly wing. And it was the most comforting experience of my whole existence, because she was looking at me with this lovely smile, lovely face, high cheekbones and high forehead, sparkling blue eyes and light brown hair. I remember her position sitting there with her knees together and off to the side. And the clothes she wore, I said, were kind of a peasant garb, but they were beautiful. You know, these colors, these iridescent colors. And she never said a word to me, but her thoughts came straight into my mind. And
I want to read to you from page 41 of Proof of Heaven, Dr. Eben Alexander. Very briefly here, about the message that you said you first received from her.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the message had three parts. And if I had to translate them into earthly language, I'd say they ran something like this. You are loved and cherished dearly forever. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. End quote. And she took you to see God?
Yes. Very much. But outside of that place. I mean, there was an awareness there that I describe in the book of this soft summer breeze. It was a perfect wind that blew through that entire scene while we were there on the butterfly with millions of other butterflies in this beautiful scene with these arcs of shimmering beings up above and hymns and chants coming down from them. And it was then that this warm breeze blew through. And for me, in looking back on it, for the longest time, I would just get chills even thinking about the power of that. But it was my awareness of the divine that was all through every bit of that, and how infinitely powerful and loving and knowing that divine presence was.
I'm sorry that we're getting close to the break, Eben Alexander, but although other people have interpreted what you've said as you believing that you saw God, in the book, you actually called this going to the core.
Mm-hmm.
Before we hit the break in 10, 15 seconds, can you tell me what the core is, or do we need a further explanation?
Well, the core is basically infinite black void lit by this brilliant orb of light. It's the dwelling place of that divine. It's completely outside of all of space and time.
And you believe you there obtained knowledge that you could not have obtained here on Earth.
Yes.
So we're going to ask you about that when we continue here on Virginia Insight in a bit more than 60 seconds. Eben Alexander at one point traveled around the world doing research into the technology used to study the human brain. As a medical doctor, neurosurgeon, and medical school faculty member at both Harvard University and the University of Virginia, he had little tolerance for claims of the miraculous that supposedly occurred during so-called near-death experiences until he had such an experience himself back in November 2008. His new book is titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. The core?
The core was, I remember seeing at the very end of my time in that beautiful gateway with the butterfly wing and the lovely companion, that it all just collapsed. It collapsed down, and I remember seeing stars, galaxies, everything collapsing down, then higher dimensional space above and beyond that. What we call time on Earth collapsed into a tight loop, and but there was a higher time of causality in that outer realm. And then it was into this infinite blackness, and that was the core, and it was filled with that infinite love of the divine creator, and it was also, there was a brilliant orb of light that was right there. In a strong sense, every time I went there, because I went there repeatedly, that there were the three of us, this divine, infinitely powerful and loving creative source that you did not see, you just felt the presence of everywhere, and then this brilliant orb of light. And it's almost like that orb of light was a translator. And I would say in my early manuscript, I even said that orb of light was the guardian angel that had been on my butterfly wing, because the two events were so closely together. That is, leaving that gateway realm on the butterfly wing with the companion and going into that infinite blackness that also had this basically model of what the entire multiverse had shrunken into for all eternity.
If I understand correctly what I've heard from you before, Eben, when we've talked, and what I've read in your new book, you believe that while you were in the midst of this experience, communing with what you call the core, that you got answers to any question you ever had?
Well, I did. And the thing is, it was
and
not...
And you got knowledge that you can't really translate here on Earth into words?
Well, the problem is, it was all as flow of concepts. And it was often by showing me things, and often by having me become all of the scene.
But end result of that mm-hmm. is you believe you came across irrefutable proof that no one ever dies, that life after death is real, and that you and everyone else are just phenomenally loved and cherished.
Yes.
What happened when you woke up?
Well, I went through several cycles back to the Earthworm Eye View, then up through the gateway, then back out, always told in the core that I would be going back, not knowing what that referred to. In fact, after a while, I thought that meant the Earthworm Eye View. That was going back. And I learned that by spinning up that melody, remembering the notes of the melody, that could take me back up through the gateway and out to the core. But then I was always told I was not there to stay, and finally that's what happened, is the melody didn't work. One day it didn't. The gates of that idyllic realm were closed, and I had tremendous sadness at that time, but also trusted completely that guardian angel on the butterfly wing and that divine, all-loving deity would take care of me. And so even though I was sad that I couldn't get back in there, I trusted that I would be taken care of. And that's when I was aware of all these arcs of people going off around me, murmuring. And I describe all that in the book, and it was giving me tremendous energy. And I was kind of bubbling up on these clouds as I was coming back. And I later on, I interpreted those arcs of thousands of people going off into the darkness as praying for me. And that's where the energy was coming from that was helping me to come back. And also, assuring me that that love that I had felt and comfort was not just there in that core realm and in the gateway, but actually was part of where I was headed. And
during those 7 days that you were in that coma, mm-hmm. there were people praying for you and organizing prayer groups
right.
for you. But not long before you woke up on the seventh day, doctors were pretty much convinced you were going to die.
Well, when I had first gotten in the emergency room and I was already deep in coma and put on a ventilator very quickly, at that point, my chance of surviving this illness with such a rapid descent into coma was down to about a 10% chance of survival.
So 7 days later, there's every reason for the doctors to be thinking, we need to pull the plug. Even if by some miracle he regained consciousness, his brain functions are so damaged that he wouldn't exist in much more than a vegetative state.
Right.
And you woke up.
Yeah, it's a long time to be in coma with severe bacterial meningitis, 7 days. And it was really, they didn't want to get stuck, you know, finally eradicating the meningitis, but being left with someone whose brain was not functional in a nursing home for the rest of my life. And that was kind of the best scenario by that day seven. And so yes, then I did start waking up.
Not long after you woke up, when you regained your ability to speak, which did not happen immediately, but within a few days, you're having a conversation with your oldest son, and you realize that everything that you've ever thought about near-death experiences being a complete hoax or an illusion, you have to change some of that thinking, is what you're telling your son. And he gives you some advice. What does he tell you?
Well, Eben IV gave me the most sage advice I think I've ever gotten, and it was basically, do not read anything about near-death experiences, about physics or cosmology, and do not talk with anyone who was there when you were waking up from this coma. So I really did not talk to family members or anybody else, and I didn't read anything for 6 weeks. That's how long it took me to write down everything I could remember. It was about 20,000 words when I'd written it all out, and only then did I start reading the near-death literature, and I was shocked.
But part of what Evan was telling you is that if you read this ahead of time or you talk about it piecemeal, that will cause people to have less faith in the accuracy of your report? Is that?
Well, basically,
you'll be influenced by what other people tell you or what you read?
Right, because I told him, I said it was too real to be real. My intent at that time was to write it up as a neuroscientific report. I was only beginning to glimpse just how sick I had been and with such a severe meningitis, and over weeks came to realize I should not have experienced anything at all and not have remembered anything at all. And yet I had all these memories that are as crisp today as if they just happened yesterday.
The book is titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. Its author, Eben Alexander, is our guest. If you'd like to talk to him, we're going to open the phone lines now at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, Evan, you've been doing these incredible interviews from the cover of Newsweek to coming up this interview that you did just recently with Oprah.
Yes.
I want to play a clip of this for you. And then it's a full hour interview, and we're going to play
right.
30 seconds. But here's the 30 seconds.
How has this affected your life here on Earth? I would think that you would make a lot of your old friends uncomfortable.
They're polite. I think they put up with me.
Yeah.
But really,
but you're a good guy to have at a dinner party right now.
Well, it's like saying I walked on the moon. You know,
yes.
That's a good. That one's good at dinner.
Everybody
conversation
wants to
too.
Talk to you. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really about the message, and the message is something that resonates with people.
Has it affected your personal life? Has it affected, how do your sons?
It's affected everything.
Everything.
And it's been a beautiful gift.
So that interview actually is coming up as part of the season premiere of Oprah's show Super Soul Sunday on her own network. The first airing of it's scheduled for Sunday, December 2nd at 11 a.m. But one of the things that struck me, Evan Alexander, is that she started her question by saying, how has this affected your life here on Earth? Do you have a sense that Earth is kind of only a place where you partly exist, that you have a life someplace else too?
Well, it has changed my life, is the fair way to put it. And, you know, part of what is hidden in a lot of that manuscript that didn't make it into the current book out for the general public has to do with a lot of my adjustment of how I view physical reality, space and time, causality, free will, all those kind of vexing issues that were called into question by my experience. And I would say all of it is right here, because those realms are not out there. But likewise, it's important for people to know that quantum mechanics and kind of a modern approach to physics, string theory, that kind of thing, tells us pretty quickly that what appears to be very, you know, the space and the mass and the time flow around us appears to be pretty solid, and yet physics will tell us that deep at the core, it's not what it appears to be. And that's a huge part of my understanding.
Evan Alexander, neurosurgeon. Let's go back more than 4 years to I don't know, October of 2008, the month before your coma. If someone had come to you back then with this story that you are now telling, how would you have responded?
Well, if one of my patients had told me this story after severe meningitis, I would have patted him on the back, said, yes, you were very sick. We thought you were going to die. Nobody can believe you've come back. And I would have reassured them that when the brain is dying, all kinds of crazy things can happen. And I would have tried to convince them to just kind of let it go and get on with their life.
But in your mind, would you have thought there was any chance that what they thought was absolutely real was real at all?
I think if I had taken the time to let them explain over hours and hours the complexity of what they saw and the anchors to time that show that it occurred deep in the middle of coma and not right at the end of coma, and if I'd taken the time to listen to all that, knowing how sick they were...
That's an awfully big if, though, isn't it, Evan? I mean, part of what I'm trying to get at here, and it's something that I think you get it in your book, Proof of Heaven, is that most people in your field have an automatic response of, this simply cannot be true.
Right.
There is some scientific reason for why they experienced what they experienced. There's something that the brain was doing, because the brain is what creates consciousness, and the brain can play tricks on you.
Well, and the problem is, by having been in there myself, realized the complexity of everything that happened, the journey going back and forth from the earthworm eye view, which I thought was the best.
But Evan, what I'm trying to do now is to get you to tell me a little bit about the mindset of those people who, as Oprah was asking you about, you interact with today, who are just sort of patiently tolerant, but they're not in a place where they can jump to the conclusion that what you say was real was real?
Well, it took me months and months to begin to appreciate just what this was telling me. It was a very profound shift. And it had everything to do with knowing how consciousness does work and realizing that this was showing me a very rich environment.
So part of what you're saying, and I know this about you, Evan, because you and I have talked a number of times before, is that you had to do an amazing amount of study of things that you had never been exposed to, even though you were this incredibly qualified neurosurgeon with, it would take an hour to explain all of your credentials. And people in your field are not exposed to the kind of scientific literature that you began to study after your near-death experience.
That's absolutely true. I had to learn a tremendous amount about consciousness that I never had to know as a neurosurgeon. And that was a huge part of helping me to understand how this happened and come to a realization.
So does it surprise you that a lot of people in most fields of medicine and science hear your story and go, eh, it's a nice story.
Doesn't surprise me. And that's why if I have a little one-on-one time with them, I simply get into the hard problem of consciousness, which basically says that there's not a person on earth, no neuroscientist, no physicist, there's not a soul on earth who can write the first sentence in the chapter that tells us how the physical brain gives rise to consciousness, because they have no clue how that could happen. And what I would
say, and yet what you used to believe before you had this experience that began in November of 2008, what you used to believe as a neurosurgeon was the brain creates the mind.
Exactly.
There is no mind if the brain does not exist.
Right.
And that's flipped around 180 degrees.
It's totally flipped.
You now believe that consciousness exists, and in our Earth life, we experience some of what's available filtered through our brain. Is that
yes.
a fair summation?
Yes, that we are conscious in spite of our brain.
Dr. Eben Alexander is a neurosurgeon from Lynchburg, Virginia. He says he went through a near-death experience while in a coma from meningitis back in November of 2008. His new book is titled Proof of Heaven. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Let's go to Lou Ray. Susan, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm sorry. I am here. Can you hear me?
You're on the air. Please ask your question.
Okay. My father-in-law went through a somewhat similar experience in that he had a massive heart attack, and his cardiologist, who was also his best friend and neighbor, brought him back. He actually was officially dead, I guess, and brought back. And he experienced an amazing adventure on that short little trip. And I totally believe him, and I totally believe your guest's story. But I wonder how can someone who is very skeptical about something you can't prove scientifically or doesn't necessarily believe in God or an afterlife, how do you reconcile these stories knowing that they're true with not being able to prove them or still have so much doubt about it?
So, Susan, your basic question is, what's the proof that would be absolute?
I guess, and I suppose.
Okay, and the reason I summed it up that way is I could see by the clock that the music was going to start and that we're going to have to go to the break. So I'm going to ask Eben to address that question in detail when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute, and I want to thank you so very much for joining us. Dr. Eben Alexander is a former professor of neurosurgery at Harvard University Medical School, former director of a Charlottesville-based brain research project, and a longtime practicing neurosurgeon from Lynchburg, Virginia. His life changed dramatically when a brush with death took him through a series of lessons he now sees as conclusive proof of life after death. Dr. Alexander's new book is titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We do have a phone line open if you want to talk to Dr. Alexander at 888-WMRA-TALK. Susan's question before the break.
Well, I think the most important thing to stress is I learned, as I said, a lot more about consciousness and came to realize the hard problem of consciousness in its full power, which is that we have no clue how in the world the physical brain could give rise to consciousness. It's the deepest mystery, I think, known to all of human thought, and probably the mystery that is the furthest from possible solution.
But doesn't that kind of beg a negative? Susan's question was about your story, mm-hmm. about her relative's story, where you both and many others claim to have had something that is now commonly known as a near-death experience, that many in science explain as the brain simply playing tricks on itself. And you're saying in your case that that wasn't possible because of the condition your brain was in. Rather than say, look, we can't explain consciousness, can you say something that will provide others the kind of conclusive proof you, Eben, believe you have that this experience was real and that there is, in fact, life after death?
Well, I think the most important conclusion from my my experience, and this goes after talking it over with many colleagues, going through these nine various hypotheses that are typical of the skeptical crowd, and I was my own worst skeptic. I was addressing each and every one of these. To have that kind of rich experience when my entire neocortex was inactivated by pus proves that consciousness, of, in fact, a richer consciousness than what we're used to here, occurs when the brain and its consciousness-making neocortex is inactivated. And it shows that
so in
this
essence,
is not a brain process.
What you're saying is that all these memories that you brought back with you could not have existed. You couldn't have experienced anything during these 7 days.
Right.
You could not have memories of anything over these 7 days because the part of your brain that's responsible for memory, responsible for knowing experience, was shut down by disease.
Right. Exactly. And
so then what you're saying is, I've got these memories. I've got the story to tell you about what I experienced. I cannot put in words how incredible it was, but I'm going to try. If you tell me it was an illusion, explain to me how it could have happened because my brain wasn't working. And here's, I've seen you on different television shows showing the pictures that were, the imaging that was taken of your brain and how in essence the fundamental areas of your brain were simply shut down.
Right. And that it, like I said, it took me months of going through this because the neuroscientist in me, amazed as I was at it, that it was too real to be real, could not accept that anything other than a brain phenomenon could have caused this. And yet, when I exhausted all the possibilities, there was no way that it happened in my brain. And it was totally real.
Eben, on Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight, and we have a couple of listeners who posted comments. Anybody who wants to call in, by the way, we still have a few minutes for calls at 888-967-2825 for neurosurgeon Eben Alexander. This first comment's from Ron, who says, in an interview for BBC Radio, Dr. Alexander made several faulty claims about how the brain works, and his entire claim is invalid. You've probably gotten that before, but have a response?
Well, I think, I mean, I'd have to know more about what he's referring to that's faulty, but I think some people would point out very rightly that consciousness depends on structures that are in the lower brainstem and then in what's called thalamus, basal ganglia, and then into the cortex. So one might argue that just by eliminating all of the neocortex, and of course a lot of lower animals don't have much of a neocortex or none at all, and yet we think they're probably conscious. And so people would argue, well, you can still have plenty of consciousness, you know, with those lower parts of the brain working. And I think the thing to remember, though, is the complexity of this experience and the interactivity of the experience and the fact that it oscillated between that very primitive, unresponsive realm and then the two higher realms in the gateway and core that were far more rich. In fact, a richness in conceptualization that's beyond what my brain could do even now. That's the part that would demand a cortex, is that much higher level of function. And even if you have the brainstem and the thalamus and basal ganglia still relatively protected from the meningitis, they could not possibly muster that kind of reality because the main calculator in the brain, the most complex calculator that puts all of those very robust details of conscious existence together, is the neocortex.
Next, we're going to Stanton. Rich, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Dr. Evan Alexander, please.
Dr. Alexander, I think this is a wonderful topic, and I think this really portrays public radio as being insightful and allowing time for people to hear your story. Wonderful, and I so much enjoyed it. And I'm going to go and buy two copies of your book, share one with my wife and one with my son, who had spinal meningitis for 10 weeks, was in the hospital as a baby, and maybe this will spark something from his history.
Yes, well, thank you. I also greatly appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk with people about this.
Rich, thanks so much for your call and for the nice words about public radio. This is from Jennifer on Facebook, on our Virginia Insight Facebook page. She says, I had a similar near-death experience when I was 16. It is even more reassuring when I hear others, especially someone as credible as Dr. Alexander, speak of their experience. I know there is a heaven. Okay, there really wasn't a question there, so Evan, let me ask a question as a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
If people believe you, what do you want them to know about what you now say you know exists?
I think the most important thing to know is because of my logic in following this through about consciousness and how consciousness becomes primary and not created by the brain, to know that that inner spark of each and every one of us, that awareness, even though we're veiled from knowing that higher reality that we know when we leave these bodies, and that can be when we die, but also through deep meditation and centering prayer, things like that, we can still get in touch with this this same deep knowing within each and every one of us. But to know that what it's telling us is that our soul or spirit is eternal. That's the part that comes into these bodies when we're incarnate here on Earth, but that that part is eternal and that our souls do work together and we have relationships. And it's not just about, you know, birth to death and that's it, but that in fact our lives are far richer and more meaningful when we come to see the bigger purpose involved and that it's not all contained in this one little physical life, but in multiple lives and with a rich interaction with other souls, and at the deepest level that those souls are all one and, in fact, are divine, one with that creator.
Before we run out of time, I want to bring this full circle to where we started. So I'm going to go back to page 41 and quote again this brief message that you got from this being that you say was the first that you met, who flew with you on the butterfly wings, this incredibly beautiful young woman. Quote, the message had three parts, and if I had to translate them into earthly language, I'd say they ran something like this. You are loved and cherished dearly forever. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. Unquote. When you, after years of struggling with this, trying giving up, then having your son coming to you and say, please try one more time. I really want to see if I can meet these people.
Mm-hmm.
Finally connected, got permission to connect with your biological parents. You were how old?
Well, it turns out when my son was looking for them was in the year 2000, and the message I got was, it's not a good time to come back in their lives, and that
when, but again, I'm jumping around here trying to get you to do this quickly because mm-hmm. I know we're going to run short on time before we get to the point that's at the end of your book.
Mm-hmm.
You were how old when you finally connected with biological relatives that you had never known because you were adopted?
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you finally succeeded?
That was 54 or 53.
And the story that you heard at that time was that your biological parents had, in fact, gotten married
mm-hmm.
and had three other children.
Yes.
And you met them except for one of your biological siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Who was she? Why did you not meet her?
That was my youngest sister.
Betsy?
Betsy. And she had actually passed over in 1998. So long before I even knew that my birth parents had gotten married.
You asked your other siblings if you could have a picture of Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I don't know, they kept promising you. It didn't happen. You didn't get one. 4 months after you come back from your coma and you're in the midst of writing this long manuscript, trying to figure out what went on, trying to explain how this could happen with your brain shut down, you receive a picture of your deceased sister, Betsy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at that time, I had been really wrestling with this because I knew I was 4 months out of coma, knew I'd had a profound spiritual experience that, for me, totally corroborated the reality of so many other near-death experiences. And yet I thought, what a cruel trick. The one soul I wanted to encounter, my father, who had passed over 4 years before coma, was not there. And yet there was this beautiful girl on the butterfly wing whose face I could remember perfectly. And I saw her over and over again every time I passed through there. And yet I did not know who she was. And I was just haunted by that. And that was 4 months out, exactly as you say, when I did get a picture of Betsy. And it had a poem written over it that
we don't have time for.
Right, but that brought tears to my eyes. And I remember putting that picture on my dresser. And it was the next day reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying when she talked about a 13-year-old girl who had had a very profound near-death experience.
I'm sorry to cut you short,
okay,
but you look at the picture of
right.
Betsy, and what do you see?
Well, this is a spoiler alert for anybody reading the book, but when I looked at that picture, I saw the companion who was with me on the butterfly wing. And I can't tell you what a tremendous impact that had. It just knocked the wind out of me and was physically shocking to make that connection and realize that she was there.
I think we've got time for one more call. This is Norman. Norman, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. A question or comment quickly for Dr. Alexander, please.
Thank you. I have bought your book. I've read it. It was tremendous. The question I have is when you're in the worm's eye view and then you went into the butterfly, you were on the butterfly wing and then you eventually went to the core and you came back and forth. I know you came back, but my question is, where do you think we live after we do pass on? Do we stay in the core or do we go back into the butterfly wing area? And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that one thing that has become very clear to me is that we come back more than one time, and that our souls are eternal, and that makes a lot more sense seeing the multiple incarnations involved. But clearly the gateway, that beautiful valley in the butterfly wing, to me is simply something that we bring back when we come back in here from near-death experiences. A lot of earthly trappings, a lot of that is personal and cultural, but that outer core outside of the whole higher dimensional multiverse, that's more the home of the divine and of spirit. And I think that that is where our true higher soul resides. And in fact, in its highest form after multiple incarnations and getting it right, we approach that blissful deification that happens with becoming one with that creator in that core realm.
Norman, thank you so much for your call. To
Thank
all of
you.
Our other callers that we did not have time to get to today, my apologies. I would invite you, if you are able, to go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and post your question or comments there, and we will make sure that Dr. Alexander sees them and has an opportunity to respond.
Sounds good.
My thanks to our guest from Lynchburg, Virginia, Dr. Eben Alexander, the third author of the new book, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. Eben, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Virginia Insight's executive producers, Matt Bingay, our associate producers, Bob Levicky and Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Tony Field, Andrew Windham, and Elliot Majerzik at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to wmra.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find more information about Dr. Alexander and his work. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope to get together again soon for more insight.